quality, it doesn't show the extremes. It shows the modest average. But essentially, we will have a situation that is economic, epidemiologic, and well, those two are important enough as a genocide to how we do business, how our parks are run, how clean the air is, whether the activities we all anticipate and the benefits that we're going to derive will even be addressed or benefits to us if we have air that is so polluted with high ozone alerts and the PM 2.5 and the PM 10. And I'm speaking to Copper World and the South 32 Hermosa LLC. They're both very aggressive mining projects that will be destroying our geologic strata for the Santa Rita Mountains, and that's part of our watershed. It will also have regular explosion activity that will create the regular dust clouds that we don't see as frequent, but because we are in an inversion layer and anything that is a lower area, even this Arroyo Chico and other areas, Arito, all these connection points, they're going to hold this atmosphere against us. And that's going to be extra cancer, COPD, asthma. It's going to affect young and old. So we need to contemplate everything that we do with health and medical issues, you know, as a kind of a background issue.
Okay, that's 3 minutes.
That's all I have.
Thank you. Neil Vista, update?
Yes, that's going to be Greg. Greg has prepared a presentation.
Let's see if we can share our screen here. Are you seeing the presentation screen now?
Yes. Steve, can you
okay.
Yes.
Yep, I can't see any of you now. So if questions come up, somebody holler. Thank you, Madam Vice Chair and Commission. After the last meeting, you know, staff kind of talked about some of the questions that have come up, and we thought it might be helpful to kind of step back, talk through how we got to where we're at today, talk a little bit about risk management. We have Vince Tracy and Daniel Pardita from our risk management department here on online as well. Just going to go through a presentation, talk through how we've gotten where we got to, talk through the design, and hopefully try to educate folks on, you know, maybe the position we've taken so far. So looking at how we got here, you know, this started with Prop 407 passing back in 2018. Rio Vista Natural Resource Park has a budget in Prop 407 of about $332,000, and it specifically called out a new splash pad and renovating the existing walking path. You know, shortly after the bond passed, the community came out, kind of expressed concerns with putting a splash pad in a natural resource park. So we talked through, you know, maybe we should go out and do a master plan. And I think Jennifer, you and I have talked maybe even right after the bond passed. You know, Parks and Recreation doesn't even define a natural resource park in our park master system master plan. So that's something we got to, you know, correct going forward when we do our next system master plan, is kind of define what is a natural resource park in our park system. What are we trying to do with those types of parks, and define that going forward? Because right now it doesn't exist. So we were using this master planning process to kind of help us, you know, define what is a natural resource park, what are we trying to accomplish with those. And then more importantly, through this master planning process, we were trying to understand what was important to the community in this park and what were their priorities for improvements, because then those priorities would turn into what we would want to do with the Prop 407 dollars if we weren't going to do a splash pad. So the master plan. We selected Smith Group to do the master plan. You know, we have a list of 9 on-call landscape architect firms. We looked at the websites of those firms, looked at kind of the projects they've worked on, and Smith Group was the one that we felt had the most experience doing natural resource park master plans. They've done 3 or 4 of them up in the Phoenix area. So we contracted with them to do the master plan. I'm not going to go through all the dates. You all recall all the dates, but I'm going to put in a couple of triggers here that might kind of help you remember the process. You know, we had the in-person meeting back in September in the park. And at that point, we had the potential dog park in the master plan. Then we brought that to the park commission to adopt the master plan in October 25th of 2022, and we still had the potential dog park in there. And if you recall, we had some comments from the call of the audience that day, still concerned with the dog park, did not make a motion to support it. So, you know, we went back, had some more conversations with the council office, and at that point, we removed the dog park from the master plan and brought it back to the park commission in December of 2022. And that's when the park commission then approved it and recommended approval of the master plan to the mayor and council, who then adopted the plan on March 21st, 2023. So coming out of the master plan, these were the priorities, the top 5 priorities that we heard from the community. And in essence, the top 5 priorities then, what became the top priorities for Prop 407. That's consolidating the trail networks. And there's very specific bullets in the master plan when it comes to consolidating the trail network to close unwanted trails and provide temporary barriers to those sites, upgrade primary trails, and then revegetate the disturbed areas. And those disturbed areas are specific to trails that are being closed. The second priority was revegetating disturbed open spaces elsewhere in the park. These were not tied to specific trails, but other areas in the park where the open space has been degraded and trying to repair those areas. And a key piece of this was repairing and expanding the irrigation system. Third priority was upgrading trail network signage. Fourth was enhancing the riparian area. And then fifth was stormwater harvesting. So in essence, when we looked at these 5 priorities and said, okay, we're going to spend Prop 407 dollars. These were the 5 things we were looking at trying to incorporate first and foremost in the implementation phase. This is the map, and there's a board of this in the room there, but this is the map that was included in the master plan. And I think it's important to take a close look at this map because it's very detailed. This is the map that was included in the master planning process. This is the map that we took to the community and had on boards when we had meetings. And it's detailed from the standpoint, and it may be hard to see for those of you that are looking at this online, but you can kind of see these light green areas with the key says revegetate areas with native plant material. Well, all of these are associated with closing trails. So this map was very specific about revegetating these areas where there were previously trails that we are suggesting to close. There's very, very much detail on this little kind of a butterfly heart-shaped thing that's called node for interpretive signage. That's very specific locations of these throughout the park. The only way the consultant would have known these specific locations would have been based upon, you know, detailed information that would have been gained during the master planning process. There's very specific places to preserve bird nesting areas. There's very specific places where benches should go. So the important thing is this is a very, very specific map with in-depth detail that's pertinent that as we get further into the discussion. This is the backside of the board that we also showed during the community engagement processes. And then it really outlines the 10 priorities that came out of the master planning process. You know, the one we brought to you in October of 22 had a dog park in here. So that was the 11th priority. We took the dog park out and ended up at 10. So then we rolled into the implementation phase. And you'll note that we've got a January 2023 contract with Marsh Watershed Management Group. And, you know, just in all honesty, we didn't go to mayor and council until March of 2023 for the adoption. However, you know, our goal was to try to get implementation started as soon as we could. At this time, back in 2022, 2023, as I mentioned earlier, we have 9 on-call landscape architect firms. we had over 50 projects in some stage of design through those landscape architect firms, and they were not moving projects along as quickly as we'd liked. So we, as the staff, we were looking for opportunities to bring in other landscape architect firms, other design firms who could bring specific skill sets to take on projects. So Watershed Management Group is a firm that has extreme experience in water harvesting, GSI basins, natural resource management. They have a contract with the city through Storm the Shade and environmental services. So we looked at that contract and said, you know, their skill set is specifically what we were looking at trying to implement based upon the five priorities in the master plan. So just going back, you know, their skill set is very specific to these five areas. So we went ahead and, you know, in coordination with the ward office to making sure the council member felt confident the master plan would get approved at mayor and council in March, we went ahead and contracted with Watershed Management Group. They in turn included a subconsultant of Strategic Habitat Enhancements, and that's a firm that works on the landscaping out there. And they, you know, friends of Rio Vista is very familiar with Strategic Habitat Enhancements. They've done work for them, I think, on a couple of occasions. So, we do have Catlow Shipik with us in the audience here with Watershed Management Group. So if we got questions later on, we can actually get some clarification from Catlow. So then we get into February to August of 2023. We start going into design of the improvements. And the one thing that's important to remember, the whole point of design documents are for a landscape architect to put detailed descriptions together that we can then use to bid the project out to contractors. That's the whole purpose of design documents. At the time, for some reason, the project manager opted to take design documents out to the public and get feedback on. Quite frankly, that was a mistake. We should not be taking design documents out to the public. That's a staff responsibility. And just to give you an example, and I can't see it, but we've got a set of design documents there on the table. I think, Jasmine, you're probably sitting close to them. You know, they can be 40, 50, 60, 100 pages of very detailed documents. It's ultimately staff's responsibility to review those documents and provide feedback to our consultants. Our standard process is, and if you're not familiar with design processes, you typically get a 30% design, which is very conceptual. Then you get to 60%, which has more detail, and 90% more detail. And then eventually you get 100% design documents that you use to bid the project. So those design documents are reviewed by, if there's a building involved, our environmental and general services department reviews them because they have electrical expertise, HVAC expertise, plumbing expertise. The roofers look at it, painters look at it. And then from a staff perspective, park staff perspective, our plumber looks at it, our irrigators look at it, our electricians look at it, park operations staff, aquatic staff, if applicable. So all of the folks have the technical expertise in their particular area are looking at these plans, making comments, and giving those back to the design firm. Another critical element to take into consideration is design firms have to provide us liability insurance. If a design firm designs something and they're found negligent in that design, they're going to own some liability if somebody gets hurt. And I'll give you a very specific example that I just heard about on Monday. Several years ago, a gentleman ran into a pole on the loop trail near First Avenue and died. The city got a notice of claim. The county got a notice of claim. A notice of claim is what happens if someone gets hurt and they want to make a claim against the city or county, they got to give us a notice. McGann and his associates who designed the path got a claim. The contractor got a claim. So there were like four or five folks that got notice of these claims. Well, McGann was telling me, yeah, this is the first time they'd ever gotten a claim. They went back and looked at their design, and when they designed it, there was a 3-foot buffer between the edge of the path and the light pole. Well, at some point after the design, someone opted to widen that path all the way out to the light pole. So that's why McGann had gotten the claim, because they had originally designed it. But they did not design the extension, so they got released from that claim. But had they designed it that way, they potentially own some of the negligence if somebody gets hurt. So that's important why we got to be able to hold our design firms accountable for their design elements. And it's more important that staff are doing that and talking through that with design firms. We really can't have that as a public process. Then moving on, August 23, the project manager retires. We put it on hold. And then November 23, we hire Matt and we restart the project. So just want to touch base on, you know, just some general communication with Friends of Rio Vista, you know, specifically started back with the, well, it didn't start back. It started well before March 2024, but it's March 24 Parks and Rec Commission. You know, that was the first time the Rio Vista was on the agenda. There was concerns expressed about what we were implementing, not implementing what was in the master plan. So that's where I went up after the meeting. I approached Ms. Shopland after the conversation and said, hey, what's the disconnect? I was confused with my understanding of what we were implementing, which was thinking it was consistent with the master plan. So I was trying to understand what the disconnect was. So, you know, after a short conversation, it was really about the fact that, you know, Jennifer had sent us multiple communications and had never gotten a response back. And that was ultimately what she was asking for is, hey, I've submitted all these comments. Nobody's giving me any feedback and nobody's responding to those. So I committed to her. Resend me all the information that had been provided since the project manager was no longer here. I said, send those to me. I'll be gladly review them. We'll get your response, which I did. It was a lot of information, that, you know, we'll talk about here in a second, did result in some changes, but did resend a response to, you know, Friends of Rio Vista back in April 8th, 2024. And some of these topics still continue to come up today, even though we've brought these, you know, response to these issues back in April. A couple key takeaways came out of reviewing the information for Friends of Rio Vista. And the biggest one was we were dealing with three maps. We had the master plan map, which I showed you a second ago. There was maps put together by Watershed Management Group, which was going into the detail for the trail improvements, for the landscaping improvements. And then there was the map that people were reviewing for the entrance signs. And quite frankly, none of those maps matched each other, which when I started really delving into the details, I'm like, all right, this doesn't make sense. We've got three different maps that could potentially be showing up on the message board as you enter the park versus construction documents versus what's in the master plan. So after reviewing that, after looking at some of the preliminary design, you know, with Watershed Map had some secondary trails and primary trails, that's when we decided, well, let me clarify, secondary trails are more narrow trails, primary trails are wider trails. So we started looking at this. That's when we really looked back at the master plan, looked at the detail in that master plan and said, you know what, there's only one map we should be following, and that's the map in the master plan. So that's the direction we gave to Watershed Management Group after that April 8th letter back to Watershed Friends of Rio Vista, and basically said, hey, the maps, the trails on the master plan map are the trails we're going to follow. The revegetation is what we're going to follow. Stick to the plan that we promised the community. So that's the map we already showed you earlier, but to kind of give you the difference, this is a good one to look at. On the master plan, this trail goes away. It's revegetated. But then when I started looking at design documents, we're showing that trail. And then when I started looking at some of the, you know, secondary trails versus primary trails, you know, a secondary trail is going to be more narrow. It became obvious that if a, you know, a horse person equestrian came out through the neighborhood here, they were going to be forced onto a secondary trail, which is going to be more narrow. And since we were going to be reducing trails, that wasn't going to work. These secondary trails need to be primary trails. So that's why we went with the direction to Watershed Management Group was like, you know what, we're reducing trails. They all need to be at least 6 foot, preferably 8 or more. And then we had the map that was being reviewed for the entrance signs to the park, and the trail map on here is different than the other two trail maps that were being looked at. So, you know, we needed to clean that up or we're going to end up with different maps on different things, which really didn't make sense. And then thought it might be worth kind of sharing. Here was the existing conditions map that's in the master planning document. You know, the pink are kind of the primary trails that stayed in, but it's probably hard to see on your end, but there's lots of these little yellow trails that were kind of the secondary trails that were clearly happening throughout the park. And there's a lot of them. So the question is, you know, why do we get those secondary trails? The bottom line, it's human behaviors. You know, it's people that are like, hey, this is a shortcut for me. Why do I want to walk extra distance? If I'm just trying to get through the park as fast as I can, I'm going to take a shortcut. And that's how trails get started. It could be birders out there looking for better places to observe wildlife. It could be, and these are all likely reasons why we're getting additional trails, avoiding people. You know, if I've got a dog that's not, you know, very social with other people and I see something come down the trail, you know, you might just decide to just walk somewhere else, and then that's how trails start to begin. Or people just don't realize there's supposed to be a trail network you stay on. People just kind of go wherever. So it's the human behaviors that are creating these additional trail networks throughout the park, which was the number one priority in the master plan was to reduce those additional trails. The other benefit of that is if you can reduce those trails, all this excess traffic through there is really deteriorating the natural environment. And that's what we're trying to do in a natural resource park is protect that natural environment. So trying to reduce trails, keep people on the trails is the goal of what we're trying to implement with the master plan. So just want to reiterate, you know, when we looked at all the information that was submitted by friends of Rio Vista, it came really clear to us that the map in the master plan was specific, it was detailed, it was intentional. It didn't differentiate trail sizes, hence why we gave the direction to stick with all trail sizes to be at least the trail minimum of 6, preferably 8. It was very detailed on where revegetation should take place. It was very detailed on revegetation of open spaces, protecting bird nesting areas, where signage should be, where interpretive signage should be. So ultimately, this is the map we told the community we were going to implement. This is what we discussed with them and what they understood we were going to do based upon the master plan. So let's talk about risk management. And I know we have Vince Tracy and Daniel on here, and Vince is only here till 4:30. So if you've got specific risk management questions, we can always ask them directly. They went out and toured the park with us. But when you look at risk management, and, you know, we heard a lot about the rocks being a trip hazard. You know, risk management is much more nuanced than rocks are a tripping hazard. And I don't mean that as demeaning. I think as we go through and show you some examples of the nuances with risk management, you'll understand where I'm coming from. If you think about risk management, you know, one of the key points is really how do you reduce the exposure to risk or reduce risk exposure? And then how do you minimize the likelihood of incident? And quite frankly, there are levels of risk that we know that are acceptable, and we're fine with that. One of the key elements when you're designing a park or anything is, you know, using standards that have been adopted by an authoritative organization and following those standards, because that gives you a defendable position if somebody does get hurt. And we'll talk about some exact examples of that here shortly. But the fifth point is, you know, every state has recreational immunity laws. And what recreational immunity laws are, I literally copied the whole Arizona revised statute in here for you. It's ARS 33-1551. Happy to share the presentation afterwards. There's a link to it if you want to read it, but I put it all in here. The real key piece with recreational immunity laws is, and I'm just going to read the very first one. I'm not going to read the rest, but, you know, a public or private owner, easement holder, lessee, tenant, manager, or occupant of premises is not liable to a recreational user or educational user except on a showing that the owner, easement holder, lessee, tenant, manager, occupant was guilty of willful, malicious, or grossly negligent conduct that was a direct cause of the injury to the recreation user or education user. The last sentence here, a recreational user or educational user accepts the risk created by the user's activities and shall exercise reasonable care in those activities. This is a critical piece because It's specific to willful, malicious, and grossly negligent, which is a very high standard. So that's, and I'm going to show you later on, they define grossly negligent. And the other key piece is users have to show reasonable care. So there are known risks to any activity, you know, especially from a recreational perspective. If I decide to jump out of an airplane with a parachute, there's a known risk to me that it might not open. You know, so we're going to talk through some examples here, but this is a key piece because there are things that happen, and this isn't just for public agencies. This is true on private land as well. If you're offering a recreational immunity, and as long as you're not grossly negligent, malicious, and willful in designing something and implementing something that results in injury, recreational immunity laws apply to you. And then it really goes into defining grossly negligent here. It means knowing or reckless indifference to the health and safety of others. So there's the six sections of ARS 33-1551. So risk management specifically from the park and recreation perspective, I mean, we deal with this every day. If you look at our park operations folks and looking at the standards for playgrounds and standards for maintaining athletic fields, this is a daily thing we deal with. You know, if we see playgrounds that are unsafe, we've got to look at what steps we take from a risk management perspective and operational perspective to make them safe. Every project we review, we look at from a risk management perspective. I mean, ultimately what we're trying to do is ensure we are not negligent when we're designing or offering something to the public. Let's talk through some examples. We've got some in the neighborhood of 100 and I think 200 some playgrounds in the system. You know, we have many age playgrounds. We have folks that go out and inspect them on a regular basis. And at some point, playgrounds start to show wear and tear. And that wear and tear at some point can become unsafe. So then from a risk management perspective, you know, we have a couple options. We could remove the entire playground from the park, completely eliminate the risk. Public's probably not going to be happy with it because now we've got a playground that used to be there that's gone. Not a great solution, but clearly an option to eliminate the risk. There's a potential we could replace the part. We might have a part from a previous playground that we took apart that we could replace it, make it safe. If we have a part, we would certainly replace the part, keep the playground. Option could be, you know, let's take a slide, for example. If we can take the slide off because it's dangerous and we can remove the footer, you know, there's potential we could put a barrier up there and still make the rest of the playground available, but also eliminate the risk area and still keep it functional. So still a couple options to handle there. Another really good example is, I can tell you 30 years ago, Little Leagues did not provide certificates of insurance to cities to use our fields. I don't know if you dealt with Little Leagues. They have a tendency to kind of do their own maintenance on the fields. If a child gets hurt on that field, they're likely going to sue the city. They're likely going to sue whoever built the field, who maintained the field. They're likely going to sue the Little League. So, you know, 30 years ago, the city would not have any coverage through an insurance company for the Little League. Today, you don't use our fields as a Little League unless you provide certificate of insurance with some liability insurance. So this is just kind of a way how cities have gone about trying to mitigate the risk that could be upon us based upon users around in the park. Another good example, we've got several bodies of water in our parks. You know, this is a picture, I think, of Reed Park, the lake here. You know, is there a risk associated with someone falling in that lake? Sure. I mean, someone could be walking behind or someone could be in a wheelchair and could they fall in that lake and get hurt, potentially drown? Absolutely, that's a risk. So from a risk mitigation perspective, what choices do we have? You know, we could put a 6-foot fence all the way around that lake. That would likely eliminate the risk of someone falling in. Probably not the experience that our users want, but it would eliminate the risk. We could remove the body of water. We could fill it in. That would eliminate the risk. But this is really where the nuance comes in. What's the acceptable level of risk? If somebody falls in, should a walker or someone in a wheelchair understand there's a risk of falling in a lake if you walk by a lake? Yeah, that's probably a reasonable risk that people need to understand. But again, it's a nuance in risk management. It's not always, you just don't need to eliminate the risk. So one of the questions we heard last month was, you know, why did the consultant choose to use rocks in this particular fashion? So let's talk about that for a second. You know, the use of rocks is really twofold. You know, our focus here is keeping people on the main trails and not creating new trails. And the use of rocks, especially at the main intersections, is a very good way to help people visualize this is kind of where you should be going. And that's the whole point of why rocks were used in the major intersection areas. Again, we're trying to deter human behaviors from going wherever they want to go and keeping them on the path. I mean, ultimately, again, we're trying to protect the natural environment here. The second key reason to use rocks is really sustainability. A well-designed trail will last a long, long time. It can withstand foot traffic. Trails, well-designed trails can handle horses. They can handle bikes. More damage will be done by water on trails than people on trails. So using rocks to stabilize a trail for erosion control is a very standard practice that we're going to go into details here. So the picture on the left here, this is called a check dam or a water dam. This is I happened to be out hiking on Sunday and came across this while I was hiking. This is what's called a single track trail. It's designed for, you know, hikers. It's not open for bikes. It's 3 foot wide. So if walkers, hikers meet on the trail, protocol is uphill has the right of way. Downhill hikers should step off and let the others pass. But this is the check dam. This is, you know, rocks that are intentionally put here. They're probably 8 to 12 inches high. It's not really ZC, but 8 to 12 inches high. And the whole point of these is, you know, this is a slope coming downhill. And if you didn't have this check dam, when it rains, it would completely erode this trail very quickly. So these check dams are designed to catch the water, get it off the trail, and to prevent erosion going forward. The picture on the right is the rock causeway. And this is the specific design feature that watershed management used in the park, and it's putting rocks on one side of the trail. And as you can see, the rocks are intended to be level across the top, you know, as level as you can make rocks. And then they abut here. But the whole point of these is they prevent the trail from being eroded by water. This is a specific trail design that has been adopted by the California State Park Trails. And if you want to see the specifics of it, you know, I put a link in the presentation to the handbook. But this is an adopted trail design for preventing erosion in parks, on trails, excuse me. So talking about width of trails, you know, space next to trails, whether the rocks are a hazard, you know, the pictures on the left here, you're probably familiar with, this is the labyrinth, you know, full of rocks. Is there a reasonable expectation that someone who's in here walking the labyrinth is aware there are rocks? Yeah, that's a reasonable expectation. If somebody's in there walking, it's reasonable that they should know there's rocks. We're not going to limit those rocks just because they're a trip hazard. They're defined part of the park here. The second two pictures on the right, the third and the fourth picture, excuse me, is a picture of that rock causeway on the left-hand side there. And you'll see it's relatively flat, same level as the path. So, you know, from a risk management perspective, if a hiker, biker, walker comes across an equestrian person coming the other way, is it reasonable to ask them to step across this and get off the path? If they need to, they may not even need to, but if they need to, there's plenty of space over here for people to step off the rocks. So the question is, from a risk management perspective, is it reasonable for them to step off to the side and get off the trail? We believe that's a completely reasonable activity that you would take if you're hiking in a natural resource park. And if you look at the width of the trail, that's probably 6 to 8 feet here.
Yeah.
Reasonable width. Wanted to show you this is a diagram that came out of the Pima Regional Trails System Master Plan. This master plan was approved by the city of Tucson and adopted by the city of Tucson as well as Pima County. This is a picture of the standard trail design for a multi-use trail. A multi-use trail is specifically designed for multiple users, as in bikers, equestrians, hikers, all using the trail at the same time. So it's a very specific design standard in anticipation of multi-user groups. And what's critical is, you know, the minimum recommendation for a trail width is 8 feet with a two foot shoulder. So that 2 foot shoulder is designed so that if someone has to get off the trail because of giving way to somebody else coming down, if they need and there's space to get off the trail, that's what that 2 foot shoulder is for. It was interesting in reading the California trails design standards that one of the comments they made is that multi-use trails are some of the most difficult to deal with for several reasons. You know, most trails you meander so that you're not just looking, you know, 100, 200 yards down in front of you at whoever's in front of you. Most trails meander so that you're seeing the landscaping and but still have the ability to see people within a short distance. Problem with multi-use trails is most of them are built very, very straight because they want good visibility because there's potentially bikers coming and there's equestrians out there. So a lot of times they're built with long, narrow straightaways. And with long, narrow straightaways, guess what bicyclists like to do? Well, they like to go as fast. They like to go as fast as they can go on these long straightaways. So it's just a challenge. It's not new. It's been a challenge for years that, you know, multi-use trails, long straightaways become a challenge, and it's just part of what you deal with when you're dealing with a natural resource park and multi-use trails. Wanted to show a couple other pictures. This is a picture we went out and kind of toured the rock causeway out here. This is the one area. And we talked about the goal is 8 feet. At this point, the trail is probably only about 6 feet. This is on the southern end of the park. You know, when we looked at this area, Joe in the picture there and I went out to this park, geez, I think in May or June when Matt was on vacation. And we weren't concerned with the 6 foot path here. What we were concerned with is there was no visibility on what might be coming from the other side. So, you know, this bush that's right behind Joe there, we're going to remove that bush because that bush would create better visibility for what might be coming your way. The other interesting thing, if you look at this, there's actually a tree in the background. So, you know, if we were going to mandate that this trail be 8 foot, it's likely this tree would have to be removed. So that's where we have to balance. All right, it's a natural resource park. We're trying to keep the natural environment and the natural landscaping. Is it more important to have an 8 foot trail, or is it okay if the 6 foot trail for 10 or 15 feet with space for people to step off if need be, but keep the tree? So we're trying to use a little bit of logic as we go through and look at different areas where there are some visibility issues. If this bush comes out and there's still visibility issues, then that tree is going to have to go. It'd be a safety issue. Second picture, you know, this is kind of a common what you see along the side of the trail. This is not a densely vegetated park, hence why we have to do so much revegetation. In both these pictures, you see, you know, here's the main trail corridor. There is lots of open space. And quite frankly, why it's easy for people like birders to be out looking for wildlife, there's really nothing to keep them in. So the concerns that we keep hearing about the trails are too narrow and there's no place to get off the trails, I just don't understand it. There's lots of open space in much of the trail network. Here was a picture we took with the risk management folks. This is kind of where the central hub of the trail network where multiple trails are coming together. This trail is probably 25 to 30 feet wide right here. I think this is the picture that we were talking about, or the rocks we were talking about the last commission meeting about why are these rocks here in the middle of the path. So two things. And Catlow can correct me, but I think this is called a dissipation area. The intent of these rocks is to reduce the water flow as it comes through the park because the wash is right behind this area. So these rocks are intended to help prevent erosion. Now, are they a trip hazard? Well, there's 25 to 30 feet of open space. If someone wanted to walk across them, you know, they're fairly level. There are rocks in a nature area, so they could walk across them, but quite frankly, there is plenty of space here for folks to get by each other if they need to. And then just another picture on the right. You know, this is what you're looking at if you're looking, walking along the trail. A lot of open space out there. But that also encourages the social trails or the extra trails being developed. because there isn't a lot of vegetation to prevent people from going places. Another picture here, kind of a major intersection, and just kind of how the rocking is intended to help people visualize where they're supposed to stay and on the trails. Second one here, this is over off, I believe, Cactus, an area where the, you know, seasonally the grass is growing up here. This is a video. We'll see if it works. But it kind of gives you a good idea of, all right, trail's a little bit narrow there, but if you need to step off the trail, plenty of room to do that. Well, actually hearing sound. Are you hearing sound too? You know, I think it was brought up last meeting, this grass growing up through the rocks. Absolutely. That's a maintenance responsibility. You know, if we're going to have rocks, like to orient people and get them going in the right direction, if there's grass going in there, we're going to need to get that grass out of there. Quite frankly, if these trails are used as much as we anticipate them being used, that grass won't survive because the traffic will kill grass off. I mean, one of the best ways to see if a trail's being used if you're out hiking is whether vegetation's growing up or not. If it's got high vegetation, it's not a heavily used trail. But again, kind of another video to kind of give you a feel of the open space that surrounds these trails. See? Plenty of room to step off need be. Last couple slides. You know, we heard comments about the safety concerns of, you know, brushing out trails. And that's what the picture on the left here is. You know, this is one of the trails that we're trying to close. The first step was what's called brushing it out, which is putting debris down there to make it, you know, not look like a trail, discourage people from walking down there. We're also signing it. You know, again, this is a very standard way of trying to deter people from using trails. It's used by trail folks all over the country. We heard concerns about, you know, brushing out, you know, piling it up here. This is a pretty open area, and we've got brush piles here, again, trying to deter people and keeping them on the trail. I'm going to show you the video here. Oh, what happened? Let's see if it's bad again. So this is kind of that same main trail area. There's the rocks. I'm going to show you in the – oh, stop. This is the brush out you see in the backside here. This thick brush here is the brush out along this edge. Again, this is a 25 to 30 foot wide trail. So there should be no reason for anybody to have to try to, you know, step over this brush out. There's plenty of other space for people to get out of the way of other users coming through the park. You know, one of the things that Friends of Rio Vista was, you know, in their communication was always about, you know, have you reached out to experts in the field? So we took that request to heart. We invited Sue Clark, who's with the Pima Trails Association. Sue has been pivotal in building trails, starting trails, been riding horses, I think she said, in this area for 41 years. Someone who I would clearly consider an expert as far as, you know, understanding what trails are. We took her out there on August 19th. We looked at these, looked at the trail network. Quite frankly, she was very complimentary of the trail network. Thought the surface was awesome, great for equestrians. She had no concerns with the rocks, had no concerns with the rock ways, you know, because ultimately equestrians have the right of way, so the horses shouldn't be stepping off there. People should be. So she wasn't worried about the rock causeways, wasn't worried about the rocks on the side of the trails, and she wasn't worried about the width. She had concerns with two things. The one area where we showed you the visibility issue was clearly a concern. And the second thing she brought up, which we had never thought about, was, you know, we took her to the spot where, at least where we understand the incident took place with the birders and the equestrian person that was thrown off the horse. And we looked at that area very specifically. And we kind of explained to her what we understood from the letter. And her concern was, you know, that's a somewhat vegetated area with some trees, likely place where birders would be hanging out. Her concern would have been if the birders got off the trail, which the letter said they did, so that the horse could pass through, she was concerned that maybe if someone stepped back out, if they were kind of hidden behind a tree and stepped back out towards the trail, that could spook a horse. So, you know, we talked through about, you know, we may need to think about signage that is step off the trail, let equestrians pass, but stay visible. Because what she says, you don't want people stepping behind a tree, comes out of sight of the horse, and if they step back in, that's what could spook a horse. So that was her only real concern out there and something we had not thought about, but it was good input that that Sue shared with us. We took our risk managers out there on September 9th. Again, did the tour. No concerns from them as far as the rocks, the widths of the trails, the ability for people to step off. They were fine from a risk management perspective. And then, you know, we are designing these to the standards that have been adopted by the city and the county through the Pima Trails Master Plan. You know, we've heard a lot about our master plan is going to have ecological harm. You know, the biggest negative impact on the ecology out there is going to be people, human behaviors, and invasive plants. So I think I've tried to reiterate best I can, we're trying to take the steps to mitigate human behaviors. And then we are also, by reducing the trail network to improve the wildlife and the ecology out there by revegetating. And then we've also been very specific about removing the non-native and invasive plants, doing that in a very ecological sensitive way. We've worked very closely with the Tucson Audubon Society to make sure that we aren't removing trees when it's nesting season. So, you know, we are being very sensitive to the ecology of the park and trying to improve it, not be detrimental to it. The plan also calls out very specific areas for water harvesting, which really is long-term, one of the improvements, one of the things we need to do for the long-term ecology of the park. So that's something we've implemented in phase one here. We've heard a lot about, you know, we've got sustainability flaws. I think we've heard about, you know, concerns about planting 300 plants and we don't have the ability to keep them alive. We are very confident that this is a natural resource park that has had a very engaged community. We've been very confident that we can engage volunteers to help with this process. We feel very confident that through their assistance, we can plant 300 plants. You know, you're going to have loss. You're going to have theft. That's going to happen. But we're very confident we got enough volunteers out there that can help us accomplish the goal of getting 300 plants in the ground. Progress to date. We have ordered 30 of those signs you see on the bottom left here. The yield signs, what this sign is showing you is that bikers yield to hikers, hikers yield to horses, and bikers yield to horses. So, you know, if there's anything that we need to help educate people on is the protocol for who yields to whom, because ultimately this is what's going to result in conflicts. If somebody doesn't yield, this is likely what's going to result in a conflict. So we're going to put 30 of these signs up. One of the folks has suggested we include these on all of the signs where we're closing the trail, which is a great idea. So we've ordered 30 of these. Matt can tell you if we need to know, but they're on order. We expect them, I would think, here in the next couple of weeks, and we'll get those up. On the right side, you see the park rules sign. We put those up at all the main entrances. That's done. There's a second sign that will go up. You kind of see on the right there. I intentionally cut it off, but now I thought about it. You know, that's where the map will go eventually once we've finalized everything. That's where the map and some additional educational elements will happen on that second board out there. Over last weekend, we did our first kind of major planting with 74 plants put in the ground, had 25 volunteers sign up to help with that installation. Comments from the community as the installation was going on have been very positive. People like the idea that we're revegetating, trying to help the park look better. So I think that was encouraging from our first effort out there. I know the ladies out there flagging where plants are going to go gets a lot of questions about what are all those flags. And then when she says, well, that's where we're going to put plants, you know, they're excited about the improvements that are coming. So, you know, at the end of the day, We are comfortable and believe that the trails have been designed to standards that are defensible. You know, does that mean someone might trip over them and get hurt, that could happen. But we're comfortable that we developed these using standards through the California State Parks, through the City of Tucson, Pima County, that if that happens, we're in a defendable position by sharing the standards we've used to build these trails. The methods we're using for implementing this, we had a significant community engagement. They gave us very specific details, and the tools we're using to implement this is consistent with what was called out in the master plan. If there is a desire to deviate from the master plan, then I wouldn't be comfortable deviating that master plan based upon the input of just the friends group. If there's a desire to deviate from the master plan, then I believe it'd be appropriate to go back, restart and redo the master plan and have the community feedback. I don't believe it'd be appropriate just for us to take feedback from one group and not go back to the greater community. So that's kind of where we stand right now. Happy to answer questions. I know our risk manager is only here for another couple minutes if he hasn't dropped off. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Greg. It was a very intrinsic presentation, very detailed. Thank you. Steve, did you have any questions, comments?
About risk management, my major concern, and you've already addressed one of them, and that is the grasses. And I believe you said when the grasses were covering up the rocks, we would make sure that there was maintenance done to alleviate that situation so that people wouldn't stumble upon those rocks unaware. That part I like. The part that I'm concerned about that you didn't address is there are several stretches where those rocks are lined up right next to each other, contingent to each other, for a great number of feet, whether that be 20 or 30 or 40 feet. And if somebody did need to get off of there, if they were pushing a stroller, if they were riding a bike, if they were an old person that might be with a walking stick or a cane and they have to step over, I think there needs to be some breaks every 10 or 15 feet for a, like a 5-foot break, so that there would be a possibility of those people being able to step off without having to worry about getting over those rocks, because you can't do that with a baby carriage or a bicycle that you're on. I like to think I'm young enough that I can step over them, but that may not always be true. So why, if you're going to have these long stretches, why not have some place in there about every, say, 15 feet or something like that for there to be a break and get those out of the way for a few feet?
Yeah, I think that's something we can certainly consider, Mr. Poe. I think when you got to look at, is it a reasonable expectation? If you're coming out here with a stroller and you do come across somebody coming the other way, I mean, the reality is if you just stop, these paths are wide enough that if an equestrian person is coming at you, if you just stop, they should be able to get by you with no problem. I don't know what the scenario that would be created would cause a stroller to need to get off this. Secondly, if you're out there with a stroller, you've got to understand the environment you're in. If you're in a natural resource park, there are going to be limitations, and you need to understand those limitations. So part of that is upon the user to understand what the limitations are that they may come across in the park. Vince, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, just to add additional to that, in those situations, we've had that been brought up at other times, especially when I worked for Pima County in the same position. And what's easier? I mean, taking a step over some rocks, but if your next stop is another 15 feet away or 7 feet away, that takes too long to get to that next section to even push it out of the way. So we're looking that these are parks that are made and designed this way. You are going to have natural things and some rocks that you may have to step over. But again, most of these are wide enough to where even if there's a bicycle or a horse, you can step to the other side of the path and still have enough room to cross. And I'm sorry, but I do have to get off.
Go ahead. The only part that I have a disagreement with that is where you said where the paths are wide enough. And there are many places where they're not wide enough, and I think that there needs to be a break in those paths where they are not wide enough
And when you say not white enough, what would be your definition of not white enough? How to, just so I can fully understand the areas you're thinking about.
Well, I'm thinking of the areas that are not 8 feet wide. So areas that are less than that, I think there needs to be a place for people to get off, because when you have a, whether it's a bicyclist that's coming towards you or whether you have a horse or whatever, you know, if it's less than 8 feet, then I think you've got an issue.
That helps me understand when you're thinking width. That helps us understand that we could look at those areas and how many of those areas are out there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I do have to get off. If you have any further questions, I'm willing to take it. You can send me an email or contact me in my office. You can get the information from Parks and Rec.
Thanks, Vince. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Becky.
Thank you.
Yeah, I do. There's a few things I'm going to go down a list. Greg, when you mentioned that when you thought these trails were going to get enough use where you wouldn't get that kind of grass, the grass isn't coming from the trails. The grass is coming from the nature area over the rocks. The trails, I've been walking those trails sometimes up to 3 times a day for years. Those trails have never had a problem for people to be able to see where they were. They never required those rocks before. And mainly trails. And areas like I sent photos to everyone, you could see the short view of where that grass had gone over those rocks. And then you could see the larger view of how, and it's a major trail. So if a runner is running and they want to get a berth to a horse, if they move over a little bit, they aren't going to see those rocks. That's risk management. I wish risk management could stay. That was very I appreciate the length of it, but I think it's more limited to specific things.
I'm not catching a lot of her. It's breaking up on my end. I don't know about you guys.
Any better if I get closer?
That would be good.
All right. So the other issue is when on July, in our July meeting, I asked specifically from Matt, because I had not seen the rocks yet. When he started speaking about the rocks, that's the first I heard of it. I didn't know that was part of the master plan. I didn't see rocks in the master plan. I asked where they were going to be because I instantly had a feeling that there might be a problem. And he said it was just going to be on the crossway so people would know how to go. That's not what we're seeing. We're seeing them on the edges of a lot of things. And I know that you said this is a lot about water and preserving the trails. I understand that. But there's absolutely no need to have them on the way to the main trail back to the barn. And I agree completely with Steve Poe. Greg, with respect, you're a tall man with long legs. I am a short woman with short legs who's had health care. Even at my age, I've had trouble getting over some of the brush and everything to get out of the way of a horse, traveling another horse behind me. Isn't it much? And so people need to go over. If they have a baby, dogs, problems.
You're breaking.
For that. We were told that we weren't going to have any more input, and you weren't accepting any more input, and yet there were trails closed as a result of input from one resident. So
that's not a true statement.
For that, I just want to point that out. More trails were taken down than we thought from the beginning. While I appreciate all the signs and everything, people don't always read signs. There's one other aspect that keeps being forgotten. The more you rewild, the more the wild comes to the trails. So 8 feet may be okay in your mind for a lot of things, but what if there's a rattlesnake? And, you know, so then everybody has to backtrack in multiple different directions, and they may not see it immediately. So I've been in that position there. I've also been in that position with Bobcat and Javelina, and Javelina can be quite aggressive. In the past, there was always a way to get away from them, and right now there doesn't seem to be those choices anymore. And that's something we really think about.
So just want to clarify about the comment about taking input from other user groups. We have not taken – the only input we've gotten since the master plan ended is from Friends of Rio Vista. So no other input has been provided as far as closing trails. The decision to stick to the master plan was made by staff after reviewing the multiple maps. There was no other input about closing trails. The decision was look at the map that was provided in the master plan. That's what we told the community. That was the map we had decided to follow. That was not based on any other community engagement or any other input from any citizens.
So for clarification, the trails on the two trails on the north side of the park were always going to be closed, or are they from the very beginning?
Let me go back to the master plan map right here. Let me share. This is the map for the master plan. I'm going to make it bigger for the north end there. I think that's the area you have in question.
There was another map where they were in pink that was easy to see, right?
Yeah, but this is the master plan map. So I want to always refer to the master plan map because that's the map we're following. But that's where it gets confusing. When you start looking at other maps, it gets confusing. So this is the master plan map. I think this is the trail you had in question. And in the master plan, it was always closed. But in the map that was on the for the sign and on one of the designs, it was showing still in place. It was when I reviewed all of the different maps after some of the questions that came from Friends of Rio Vista, that's when we said, hey, you know what? We've got multiple maps. We're sticking to this map. So this map is the one that was in the master plan, and that trail has been closed in the master plan and revegetated.
Could you put up map 13? What is that?
On page 13?
Yes.
So this, that was the one you were mentioning. Zoom back out, sorry.
That was a good one.
Yeah, that was comparison of what the existing conditions were back in, April of 2022 compared to the master plan map that was adopted. And I'm happy to share this presentation. You can have all these examples of these.
Could we, may I say something, Manon?
Yeah. Can I just finish up one last question?
Yes.
I would just like to ask, because I don't know, have there been detailed reported accidents on the trails before the new master plan? And you may have to look some stuff up. So I just like an answer.
I don't know if there has been.
Because we had one pretty quick after it was implemented. And I think that should be when we should. And this is where we don't need rocks, just so people with strollers and everything can get over. That's something we could also. And I don't want to do this, to not include people with babies, strollers, hip replacements, because this is otherwise a flat trail that is very easy to walk and always has been. And this is where a lot of people go who have certain abilities that aren't easily seen. They can be in nature. They can't do the trails that you see in many other places around this area. So thanks for the.
Thank you. Okay.
You want
to? Yes, because, well, there was 10 minutes on the agenda for this. We keep going this direction. What didn't I read? How did I miss this? I had no idea there was a presentation today. Did I miss something? Did something go out? All I saw was we were going over signs. So I have tons of notes. I have my whole Rio Vista file. And when people call me about this today, I said the only thing on the agenda It's only a 3:30 to 4:30 meeting. There's 10 minutes on the agenda. We have a meeting that is being scheduled with Councilmember Dahl. So the only thing we're going over is signs. That's what I told people. That's what I understood, that we're going over signs. So I was prepared for Matt to come in and show us what you have in mind. I am not prepared for this. My heart is pounding out of my chest. I feel completely disrespected. I don't know how this is a Rio Vista. A friend of Rio Vista versus the master plan discussion. And that's how it feels to me. And it feels extremely uncomfortable. You know, I'm just like shaken. Did we know this was happening? Did the commissioners, am I completely off base on this?
Not a bit.
So not a bit, Ross. You did ask for a number of questions.
Yes, for an agenda item. And then you called for a meeting with Councilmember Dahl.
I did reach out to Councilmember Dahl because this is an item that keeps on getting visited. And I asked if he'd be willing to do a meeting. And that is exactly what he has set up. That is separate from the last meeting where there was an inquiry into signs, but there also were a substantial list of questions asked. Manon specifically, I remember asking, why did you use rocks in the design? Why?
And this is good information to have to go into that.
Right. So that's what we're trying to provide back to you all based on the questions that were asked last month.
Correct.
I had no idea.
I mean, it's the agenda
did not mention that.
I would have been more prepared. I feel unprepared. I feel like I said, my heart is just.
But there's also nothing that stops you from bringing questions to the next meeting as well.
Of course. When people from the community called the neighborhood, this is in Ward 3, what I said was that we will be meeting with Ward 3. We'll be having more discussion. And so my idea, what I was going to come in today and was just asked to postpone this, and this is what I told people from the community, just to postpone this conversation. We're having a meeting with Councilmember Dahl, and then we'll come back and have discussion. And so in my mind, that's where we were going.
But nothing stops that. We can still do that.
Right, we are.
But we're also trying to address the questions that were logged last month.
Which I would have brought my notes for.
Which we can still, we're not asking for any action today. We're just trying to do follow-ups.
And I appreciate that, but the agenda made it sound like this was going to be a much shorter presentation and did the amount of time that was allotted for this meeting. I just had a surgery.
It did.
I was expecting a 45-minute meeting, not a 45-minute presentation on Rio Vista.
And all the agenda says was Rio Vista sign update. There was no indication of anything else.
So it was obviously a great amount of effort put into this report. It's great information. I'm just not prepared to do anything with it.
So I lied. I said it was going to be a quick meeting. Obviously, I lied.
No, Becky.
It's going to be a quick meeting. But that, you know, it's like so great information. Thank you for all the work. Kind of cut us all off guard. But this is great information to take to your meeting at Board 3.
Yeah, I would like to make a motion that we... that you can Parks and Rec coordinate the meeting with Ward 3, and then we'll pick this up on the agenda again next month.
I'll second that.
Roll call.
Sorry. Okay. Chair Steve Pope?
Yes.
Vice Chair Becky Quintero?
Aye.
Commissioner Manon Getsy?
Aye.
Commissioner Robin McArdle?
Aye. Commissioner Darren Gregg.
So, yes, but I want to make a comment. I think that actually, to be honest with you, yeah, it's the Ward 3 thing, the meeting needs to happen, but there's an approved master plan. I think the answer back to the community, to be perfectly honest with you, is let the master plan be fully implemented, and then it'll go back into a stage of community inputs from there. I really don't think that this should be a continuing topic for the commission. I've only been to two of these, and this topic is taken up almost all of the time from both of those meetings.
I agree.
I really do think that we need to give them an opportunity to execute the full master plan, and then it go back out for comments, and then of course have the Ward 3 meeting as well. But so that's my input.
Great.
Motion passes. Yeah, all in favor.
So, moving on. Reports and announcements. Parks and Rec commissioners. Do you have anything to announce or comment on?
No, ma'am. Not from here.
Anon.
You're muted.
Thank you. There was a lot of meetings recently about the Reed Park golf course and a reevaluation of what may work after the sort of master planning process through a former agency. And I think that's very interesting meeting with a lot of different viewpoints all in the same room. A lot of historical knowledge I didn't find. So I thought that was, it was really good to get everybody in the same room because it's always interesting to hear so many different perspectives. And also I'm curious, I was at the Tucson Pops concert on Sunday and the ballpark lights were on and they announced that there was some kind of safety issue, and I was just curious what might have been back from the music cars when the lights are blasting like that.
I would have to ask. I don't know off the top of my head.
Were they all on or just one set?
It was all on. I mean, the last time I remember that happening was when there was a full moon eclipse and everybody came to see it. Suddenly all the lights were on and nobody knew why. At this point, I guess a lot of people started asking about it, and we got an announcement from the conductor saying that there was a safety issue. So I wondered what that was. And if that's what we're going to expect more of in the future.
Thank you. Robin?
No, thank you.
Darren?
No.
No? Okay, thank you. I just nothing for me right now. So staff. Oh.
Staff updates.
I'll be brief. September, we started our fall programming, so we're back from August, closing down some of our facilities to get them back in shape after summer. September, we're fully open. We had some great events, including UDAL wrapped up our open house series. They had their big open house mid-September. They actually brought in $34,000 worth of membership sales. We had a discount on Universal Passes, so that was a big success for UDAL. We are looking at doing the open houses again for 2025. We've got some plans to kind of change our formatting and making the events more consistent throughout the city. We had our El Pueblo Mexican Independence Day Fiesta, which was a great event. We brought in seniors from different facilities. They had the multi-purpose room decked out with decorations. We had a DJ, raffle prizes. They had mocktails and catered by Little Mexico, so that was a fun event. And then last Saturday, we had our Ready, Set, Rec, the mobile rec program, the fall kickoff at Reed Park. We had about 500, 600 people maybe. It was a great turnout, good weather. We had good raffle prizes, music, and a food truck out there. So they're rolling out their fall schedule starting in October. And then we're just getting ready for Halloween, all the Halloween events for October. So looking forward to the big Boo Bash at Lincoln Park next month.
As far as park maintenance goes, aside from the report, a lot of the stuff that we're doing right now is finalizing the storm cleanup efforts with our contractors and with our teams. There's still a lot of stuff out there that we're trying, we piled up elsewhere that we could try to get rid of through time. And then a big focus right now is, I know recreation's got a lot of events and a lot of vendors coming into town, so we're working through all the event spaces, trying to get those cleaned up and prepped for the winter events. That's mostly it.
All right. Currently, we still have 10 pools still open and all of our splash pads. The splash pads will wrap up around Halloween. In regards to splash pads, I went to a meeting today for the JO splash pad, and it looks like we're probably about three to three and a half weeks out from opening that splash pad. Last weekend, we had an instructor development candidate school for lifeguard instructors, and we certified 9 new lifeguard instructor trainers and renewed 2, including myself. I attended my first Barra Nepal park meeting, and we had staked out the pad and at least our end of the aquatics room, where the chlorinator and acid feeders and pumps will be. And that was my first meeting. Well, that was my second meeting with them. I hadn't been to one since May. And then we're wrapping up swimming lessons at the ARC, and looking back on it, I think we can even do more in that regard in the fall in future years. So that's where we're at right now.
Well, I have nothing that exciting to add. Fast pitch league ended in August. Our slow pitch softball started. So we got fall ball going on. Hard to believe, but, the Vail school system is on break. So our first schools out camp is going on right now in September. So a little bit of adjustment for me getting used to that. And then we are just flying into special event season. Everybody wants to do everything they can outside, so, and I don't blame them because it is absolutely beautiful outside. So, all special events, all go, go, go.
To share that we have onboarded our a new project manager as of Monday. Stephanie Copeland joined us previously with Tucson Audubon Society, before that with different parks and recreation agencies and other places. Excited to have her on board. And the other big news is a couple weeks ago, Mayor and Council approved additional funding to Cushing Street Skate Park. So that one is getting closer and closer to meeting the cost estimates we have for construction there. And then wanted to share with the commission that I serve on the steering committee for the Pima County Connecting Children to Nature Network. That's work that is happening kind of across the whole region with folks from United Way leading the charge. We have different organizations, educational organizations, early childhood folks involved in that space. So thinking about how we're bringing nature-based play into our park system, nature-based education programs as well. So I've chatted with KidCo and other centers on bringing programs from other partners in that steering committee together. So just wanted to let you all know our next in-person meeting is happening at the Peace Garden. So excited for Becky to host us.
The only update I had was that we, the Housing and Community Development Department got another grant from HUD, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're continuing their engagement and activation of the Thrive in the 05 and the 29th Thrive, which is two separate areas. So we're in constant engagement with them. So that's really exciting for that.
Great.
And just some topics that will likely be coming to the commission. We currently have launched a 45-day process for the proposal to rename Mansfield Park to Doris J. Thompson Park. Sierra's going to put into the chat the link. That I don't know exactly where we are on the 45-day process, but we are receiving letters of support. So my anticipation is by the time we have our next meeting, that'll be on the agenda because the 45-day process will be over. If you recall, back in August, we had the Ka Dang Park renaming recommendation. That is actually on the mayor and council agenda for October 8th. Bless you. All positive letters of support, so I don't anticipate that that's not going to move forward. So those are kind of two things, one that you guys already approved and one coming to anticipated to be approved next month.
Okay.
So commission future agenda items, next meeting date. Does anybody have something for the future agenda item? Mr. Steve Pope, you have something?
Nothing other than what I'd already put on there.
Okay. Mena, do you have something for the future agenda item?
Nothing. It's not so much an agenda item, but I was interested to see if we've had any other accidents, as I mentioned before the master plan. Thank you.
Did you get that?
Sorry, Manon, could you repeat that? You kind of cut out towards the middle.
Sorry, I'm in a different location. I asked for before, I would be interested if we could go back and see if we've ever had a detailed accounting of an accident on the trail at Rio Vista before this was implemented, the new master plan.
To confirm, that's something we can send you once we get the report.
Thank you.
Okay.
Darren, do you have anything that you'd like to see on the future agenda item?
No, not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Robin?
I couldn't agree more with Darren, that I hope that Rio Vista comes to a positive conclusion very soon, and hopefully we'll meet with council member with Ward 3, and then we could just have an update, a quick update of that meeting.
Keyword quick.
So you want Rio Vista update to be on the
I think decision. We have to. Yeah.
Just clarifying so Diana knows.
Thank you.
So I have a quick, I've been getting a lot of questions about the Santa Cruz River Park from Valencia to Irvington and who owns it. Is it Pima County? Is it city? And why does it look so disgusting? And why is it closed? And all of these things, people are kind of mad about it. So can we have something about that park?
Sure. I think that might be one that is multiple jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. So we can put something together. We can find out.
Thank you. I know.
Valencia to Irvington? Is that what you said?
Yeah, Valencia to Irvington. Yeah.
Did they say both sides or just one side?
The one side. The one on the east side.
Okay. By the spectrum. That side.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that side. It's in pretty bad shape.
So I have a question as a follow-up. If it's not city maintained, do you still want a presentation on it?
If it belongs to the county, we just need to know who owns it, who's responsible for it. Yeah.
Okay.
That way we can tell Ward 1. Because, you know.
No problem.
It's, yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Dogs off leashes per request of Chair Poe from the September 4th meeting. That's the one you want. Okay. October 23rd, next meeting. Do we have a motion to adjourn? Anybody?
Yes, Becky, I will make the motion and thank you for chairing the last few meetings.
You're welcome. Do I have a second? Second. Roll call.
Yes.
Vice Chair Becky Quintero.
Aye.
Commissioner Manon Getzey.
Aye.
Commissioner Robin McArdle.
Aye.
Commissioner Darren Gregg.
Aye.
All in favor.
Aye, we're all good. Thank you and good night. It's like 5 o'clock.
Thank you.